Chapter 19. At the End of the Tunnel. In a small, self-contained universe where everyone knows everyone else, there can be no greater shock than encountering a total stranger. Heywood Floyd was floating gently along the corridor to the main lounge when he had this disturbing experience. He stared in amazement at the interloper, wondering how a stowaway had managed to avoid detection for so long. The other man looked back at him with a combination of embarrassment and bravado, obviously waiting for Floyd to speak first.
"Well, Victor," Floyd said at last, "sorry I didn't recognize you. So you've made the supreme sacrifice for the cause of science, or should I say your public?"
"Yes," Willis answered grumpily. "I did manage to squeeze into one helmet, but the damn bristles made so many scratching noises no one could hear a word I said."
"When are you going out?"
"Just as soon as Cliff comes back. He's gone caving with Bill Chant."
The first flybys of the comet in 1986 had suggested that it was considerably less dense than water, which could only mean that it was either made of very porous material or was riddled with cavities. Both explanations turned out to be correct. At first, the ever-cautious Captain Smith flatly forbade any cave exploring. He finally relented when Dr. Pendrell reminded him that his chief assistant, Dr. Chant, was an experienced speleologist. Indeed, that was one of the very reasons he had been chosen for the mission.
"Cave-ins are impossible in this low gravity," Pendrell had told the reluctant captain. "So there's no danger of being trapped."
"What about being lost?"
Chant would regard that suggestion as a professional insult. He's been 20 kilometers inside Mammoth Cave. Anyway, he'll play out a guideline.
"Communications?"
"The line's got fiber optics in it, and suit radio will probably work most of the way."
"Where does he want to go in?"
"The best place is that extinct geyser at the base of Etna Junior. It's been dead for at least 1,000 years.
"So I suppose it should keep quiet for another couple of days." "Very well. Does anyone else want to go?"
"Cliff Greenberg has volunteered. He's done a good deal of underwater cave exploring in the Bahamas."
"I tried it once. That was enough. Tell Cliff he's much too valuable. He can go in as far as he can still see the entrance, and no further. And if he loses contact with Chant, he's not to go after him without my authority."
Which, the captain added to himself, I would be very reluctant to give. Dr. Chant knew all the old jokes about speleologists wanting to return to the womb, and was quite sure he could refute them.
"That must be a damn noisy place, with all its thumpings and bumpings and gurglings," he argued. "I love caves because they're so peaceful and timeless. You know that nothing has changed for 100,000 years, except that the stalactites have grown a bit thicker." But now, as he drifted deeper into Halley, playing out the thin but virtually unbreakable thread that linked him to Clifford Greenberg, he realized that this was no longer true. As yet, he had no scientific proof, but his geologist's instincts told him that this subterranean world had been born only yesterday, on the time scale of the universe. It was younger than some of the cities of man. The tunnel through which he was gliding in long, shallow leaps was about 4 meters in diameter, and his virtual weightlessness brought back vivid memories of cave diving on Earth. The low gravity contributed to the illusion. It was exactly as if he was carrying slightly too much weight, and so kept drifting gently downward. Only the absence of all resistance reminded him that he was moving through vacuum, not water.
"You're just getting out of sight," said Greenberg, 50 meters in from the entrance. "Radio link's still fine. What's the scenery like?"
"Very hard to say. I can't identify any formations, so I don't have the vocabulary to describe them. It's not any kind of rock. It crumbles when I touch it. I feel as if I'm exploring a giant Gruyere cheese."
"You mean it's organic?"
"Yes. Nothing to do with life, of course, but perfect raw material for it.
All sorts of hydrocarbons. The chemists will have fun with these samples. Can you still see me? Only the glow of your light, and that's fading fast. Ah, here's some genuine rock. Doesn't look as if it belongs here. Probably an intrusion. Ah, I've struck gold. You're joking. It fooled a lot of people in the Old West. Iron pyrites. Common on the outer satellites, of course, but don't ask me what it's doing here. Visual contact lost. You're 200 meters in. I'm passing through a distinct layer. Looks like meteoric debris. Something exciting must have happened back then. I hope we can date it. Wow! Don't do that sort of thing to me. Sorry. Quite took my breath away. There's a big chamber ahead. Last thing I expected. Let me swing the beam around. Almost spherical. 30-40 meters across. And I don't believe it. Halley is full of surprises. Stalactites. Stalagmites. What's so surprising about that? No free water. No limestone here, of course. And such low gravity. Looks like some kind of wax. Just a minute while I get good video coverage. Fantastic shapes. Sort of thing a dripping candle makes. That's odd. Now what? Dr. Chan's voice had shown a sudden alteration in tone, which Greenberg had instantly detected. Some of the columns have been broken. They're lying on the floor. It's almost as if... Go on! As if something is blundered into them. That's crazy. Could an earthquake have snapped them? No earthquakes here. Only microseisms from the geysers. Perhaps there was a big blowout at some time. Anyway, it was centuries ago. There's a film of this wax stuff over the fallen columns, several millimeters thick. Dr. Chant was slowly recovering his composure. He was not a highly imaginative man. Spelunking eliminates such people rather quickly, but the very feel of this place had triggered some disturbing memory. And those fallen columns looked altogether too much like the bars of a cage, broken by some monster in an attempt to escape. Of course, that was perfectly absurd, but Dr. Chant had learned never to ignore any premonition, any danger signal, until he had traced it to its origin. That caution had saved his life more than once. He would not go beyond this chamber until he had identified the source of his fear. And he was honest enough to admit that fear was the correct word. Bill, are you all right? What's happening? Still filming. Some of these shapes remind me of Indian temple sculpture. Almost erotic. He was deliberately turning his mind away from the direct confrontation of his fears, hoping thereby to sneak up on them unawares by a kind of averted mental vision. Meanwhile, the purely mechanical acts of recording and collecting samples occupied most of his attention. There was nothing wrong, he reminded himself, with healthy fear. Only when it escalated into panic did it become a killer. He had known panic twice in his life, once on a mountainside, once underwater, and still shuddered at the memory of its clammy touch. Yet, thankfully, he was far from it now, and for a reason that, though he did not understand it, he found curiously reassuring. There was an element of comedy in the situation. And presently, he started to laugh. Not with hysteria, but with relief. Did you ever see those old Star Wars movies? He asked Greenberg. Of course, half a dozen times. Well, I know what's been bothering me. There was a sequence when Luke's spaceship dives into an asteroid and runs into a gigantic snake creature that lurks inside its caverns. Not Luke's ship, Han Solo's Millennium Falcon. And I always wondered how that poor beast managed to eke out a living. It must have grown very hungry waiting for the occasional tidbit from space. And Princess Leia wouldn't have been more than an hors d'oeuvre anyway. Which I certainly don't intend to provide, said Dr. Chant, now completely at ease. Even if there is life here, which would be marvelous, the food chain would be very short. So I'd be surprised to find anything bigger than a mouse, or more likely a mushroom. Now let's see. Where do we go from here? There are two exits on the other side of the chamber. The one on the right is bigger. I'll take that. How much more line have you got? Oh, a good half kilometer. Here we go. I'm in the middle of the chamber. Damn, bounced off the wall. Now I've got a handhold. Going in head first. Smooth walls, real rock for a change. That's a pity. What's the problem? Can't go any further. More stalactites. Too close together for me to get through, and too thick to break without explosives. And that would be a shame. The colors are beautiful. First real greens and blues I've seen on Halley. Just a minute while I get them on video. Dr. Chant braced himself against the wall of the narrow tunnel and aimed the camera. With his gloved fingers, he reached for the high-intensity switch, but missed it and cut off the main lights completely. Lousy design, he muttered. Third time I've done that. He did not immediately correct his mistake, because he had always enjoyed that silence and total darkness that can be experienced only in the deepest caves. The gentle background noises of his life support equipment robbed him of the silence, but at least... What was that? From beyond the portcullis of stalactites blocking further progress, he could see a faint glow, like the first light of dawn. As his eyes grew adapted to the darkness, it appeared to grow brighter, and he could detect a hint of green. Now he could even see the outlines of the barrier ahead. What's happening? Said Greenberg anxiously. Nothing. Just observing. And thinking, he might have added, there were four possible explanations. Sunlight could be filtering down through some natural light duct, ice, crystal, whatever. But at this depth, unlikely. Radioactivity? He hadn't bothered to bring a counter. There were virtually no heavy elements here. But it would be worth coming back to check. Some phosphorescent mineral. That was the one he'd put his money on. But there was a fourth possibility. The most unlikely and most exciting of all. Dr. Chant had never forgotten a moonless and luciferless night on the shores of the Indian Ocean when he had been walking beneath brilliant stars along a sandy beach. The sea was very calm, but from time to time a languid wave would collapse at his feet and detonate in an explosion of light. He had walked out into the shallows. He could still remember the feel of the water round his ankles, like a warm bath, and with every step he took, there had been another burst of light. He could even trigger it by clapping his hands close to the surface. Could similar bioluminescent organisms have evolved here in the heart of Halley's Comet? He would love to think so. It seemed a pity to vandalize something so exquisite as this natural work of art. With the glow behind it, the barrier now reminded him of an altar screen he had once seen in some cathedral. But he would have to go back and get some explosives. Meanwhile, there was the other corridor. I can't get any further along this route, he told Greenberg, so I'll try the other. Coming back to the junction, setting the reel on rewind. He did not mention the mysterious glow, which had vanished as soon as he switched on his lights again. Greenberg did not reply immediately, which was unusual. Probably he was talking to the ship. Chant did not worry. He would repeat his message as soon as he had got underway again. He did not bother, because there was a brief acknowledgement from Greenberg. Fine, Cliff. Thought I'd lost you for a minute. Back at the chamber. Now going into the other tunnel. Hope there's nothing blocking that. This time Greenberg replied at once. Sorry, Bill. Come back to the ship. There's an emergency. No, not here. Everything's fine with the universe. But we may have to return to Earth at once. It was only a few weeks before Dr. Chant discovered a very plausible explanation for the broken columns. As the comet blasted its substance away into space at each perihelion passage, its mass distribution continually altered, and so, every few thousand years, its spin became unstable, and it would change the direction of its axis, quite violently, like a top that is about to fall over as it loses energy. When that occurred, the resulting comet quake could reach a respectable 5 on the Richter scale. But he never solved the mystery of the luminous glow. Though the problem was swiftly overshadowed by the drama that was now unfolding, the sense of a missed opportunity would continue to haunt him for the rest of his life. Though he was occasionally tempted, he never mentioned it to any of his colleagues. But he did leave a sealed note for the next expedition, to be opened in 2133. Chapter 20. Recall. "Have you seen Victor?" said Mihailovich gleefully, as Floyd hurried to answer the captain's summons. "He's a broken man." "He'll grow it back on the way home," snapped Floyd, who had no time for such trivialities at the moment. "I'm trying to find what's happened." Captain Smith was still sitting, almost stunned, in his cabin when Floyd arrived. If this was an emergency affecting his own ship, he would have been a tornado of controlled energy, issuing orders right and left. But there was nothing he could do about this situation, except await the next message from Earth. Captain Laplace was an old friend. How could he have got into such a mess? There was no conceivable accident, error of navigation, or failure of equipment that could possibly account for his predicament. Nor, as far as Smith could see, was there any way in which Universe could help him get out of it. Operations Center was just running round and round in circles. This looked like one of those emergencies, all too common in space, where nothing could be done except transmit condolences and record last messages. But he gave no hint of his doubts and reservations when he reported the news to Floyd. "There's been an accident," he said. "We've received orders to return to Earth immediately, to be fitted out for a rescue mission." "What kind of accident?" "It's our sister ship, Galaxy. She was doing a survey of the Jovian satellites, and she's made a crash landing." He saw the look of amazed incredulity on Floyd's face. "Yes, I know that's impossible. But you've not heard anything yet. She's stranded on Europa."
"Europa?"
"I'm afraid so. She's damaged, but apparently there's no loss of life. We're still awaiting details."
"When did it happen?"
12 hours ago. There was a delay before she could report to Ganymede."
"But what can we do? We're on the other side of the solar system. Getting back to lunar orbit to refuel, then taking the fastest orbit to Jupiter, it would be, at least a couple of months."
And back in Leonov's day, Floyd added to himself, it would have been a couple of years. "I know. But there's no other ship that could do anything."
"What about Ganymede's own inter-satellite ferries?"
"They're only designed for orbital operations."
"They've landed on Callisto?"
"Much lower energy mission. Oh, they could just manage Europa, but with negligible payload. It's being looked into, of course." Floyd scarcely heard the captain. He was still trying to assimilate this astonishing news. For the first time in half a century, and only for the second time in all history, a ship had landed on the forbidden moon. And that prompted an ominous thought.
"Do you suppose," he asked, "that whoever, whatever is on Europa could be responsible?"
"I was wondering about that," said the captain glumly. "But we've been snooping around the place for years without anything happening."
"Even more to the point, what might happen to us if we attempted a rescue?"
"That's the first thing that occurred to me. But all this is speculation. We'll have to wait until we have more facts. Meanwhile, this is really why I called you. I've just received Galaxy's crew manifest. And I was wondering, Hesitantly, he pushed the printout across his desk. But even before Heywood Floyd scanned the list, he somehow knew what he would find.
"My grandson,"
he said bleakly. "And," he added to himself, "the only person who can carry my name beyond the grave."
Part 3. Europan Roulette. Chapter 21. The Politics of Exile. Despite all the gloomier forecasts, the South African Revolution had been comparatively bloodless, as such things go. Television, which had been blamed for many evils, deserved some credit for this. A precedent had been set a generation earlier in the Philippines. When they know that the world is watching, the great majority of men and women tend to behave in a responsible manner. Though there have been shameful exceptions, few massacres occur on camera. Most of the Afrikaners, when they recognized the inevitable, had left the country long before the takeover of power. And, as the new administration bitterly complained, they had not gone empty-handed. Billions of rands had been transferred to Swiss and Dutch banks. Toward the end, there had been mysterious flights almost every hour out of Cape Town and Joburg to Zurich and Amsterdam. It was said that by Freedom Day one would not find one troy ounce of gold or a carat of diamond in the late Republic of South Africa, and the mine workings had been effectively sabotaged. One prominent refugee boasted from his luxury apartment in The Hague, "It will be 5 years before the Kaffirs can get Kimberley working again, if they ever do." To his great surprise, De Beers was back in business, under new name and management, in less than 5 weeks, and diamonds were the single most important element in the new nation's economy. Within a generation, the younger refugees had been absorbed, despite desperate rearguard actions by their conservative elders, in the deracinated culture of the 21st century. They recalled, with pride but without boastfulness, the courage and determination of their ancestors and distanced themselves from their stupidities. Virtually none of them spoke Afrikaans, even in their own homes. Yet, precisely as in the case of the Russian Revolution a century earlier, there were many who dreamed of putting back the clock, or at least of sabotaging the efforts of those who had usurped their power and privilege. Usually they channeled their frustration and bitterness into propaganda, demonstrations, boycotts, petitions to the World Council, and rarely works of art. Wilhelm Smuts' The Voortrekkers was conceded to be a masterpiece of, ironically, English literature, even by those who bitterly disagreed with the author. But there were also groups who believed that political action was useless and that only violence would restore the longed-for status quo. Although there could not have been many who really imagined that they could rewrite the pages of history, there were not a few who, if victory was impossible, would gladly settle for revenge. Between the two extremes of the totally assimilated and the completely intransigent, there was an entire spectrum of political and apolitical parties. Derbund was not the largest, but it was the most powerful, and certainly the richest, since it controlled much of the Lost Republic's smuggled wealth through a network of corporations and holding companies. Most of these were now perfectly legal, and indeed completely respectable. There was half a billion of Bund money in Sung Aerospace, duly listed in the annual balance sheet. In 2059, Sir Lawrence was happy to receive another half billion, which enabled him to accelerate the commissioning of his little fleet. But not even his excellent intelligence traced any connection between the Bund and Sung Aerospace's latest charter mission for Galaxy. In any event, Halley was then approaching Mars, and Sir Lawrence was so busy getting Universe ready to leave on schedule that he paid little attention to the routine operations of her sister ships. Though Lloyd's of London did raise some queries about Galaxy's proposed routing, these objections were quickly dealt with. The Bund had people in key positions everywhere, which was unfortunate for the insurance brokers, but very good luck for the space lawyers.
Chapter 22 Hazardous Cargo.
It is not easy to run a shipping line between destinations that not only change their positions by millions of kilometers every few days, but also swing through a velocity range of tens of kilometers a second. Anything like a regular schedule is out of the question. There are times when one must forget the whole idea and stay in port, or at least in orbit, waiting for the solar system to rearrange itself for the greater convenience of mankind. Fortunately, these periods are known years in advance, so it is possible to make the best use of them for overhauls, retrofits, and planet leave for the crew. And occasionally, by good luck and aggressive salesmanship, one can arrange some local chartering, even if only the equivalent of the old-time once-around-the-bay boat ride. Captain Eric Laplace was delighted that the three-month stayover off Ganymede would not be a complete loss. An anonymous and unexpected grant to the Planetary Science Foundation would finance a reconnaissance of the Jovian, even now no one ever called it Luciferian, satellite system, paying particular attention to a dozen of the neglected smaller moons. Some of these had never even been properly surveyed, much less visited. As soon as he heard of the mission, Rolf Vanderberg called the Sung shipping agent and made some discreet inquiries.
Yes, first we'll head in toward Io, then do a flyby of Europa.
Only a flyby? How close?
Just a moment.
Odd. The flight plan doesn't give details.
But of course she won't go inside the interdiction zone.
Which was down to 10,000 kilometers at the last ruling, 15 years ago. Anyway, I'd like to volunteer as mission planetologist. I'll send across my qualifications.
No need to do so, Dr. Vanderberg. They've already asked for you.
It is always easy to be wise after the event, and when he cast his mind back, he had plenty of time for it later, Captain Laplace recalled a number of curious aspects of the charter. Two crew members were suddenly taken sick and were replaced at short notice. He was so glad to have substitutes that he did not check their papers as closely as he might have done. And even if he had, he would have discovered that they were perfectly in order. Then there was the trouble with the cargo. As captain, he was entitled to inspect anything that went aboard the ship. Of course, it was impossible to do this for every item, but he never hesitated to investigate if he had good reason. Space crews were, on the whole, a highly responsible body of men. But long missions could be boring, and there were tedium-relieving chemicals that, though perfectly legal on Earth, should be discouraged off it. When Second Officer Chris Floyd reported his suspicions, the captain assumed that the ship's chromatographic sniffer had detected another cache of the high-grade opium that his largely Chinese crew occasionally patronized. This time, however, the matter was serious. Very serious.
Cargo hold 3, item 2/456, Captain. The manifest says scientific apparatus. It contains explosives.
What?
Definitely, sir. Here's the electrogram.
I'll take your word for it, Mr. Floyd. Have you inspected the item?
No, sir. It's in a sealed case, 0.5 meter by 1 meter by 5 meters approximately. One of the largest packages the science team brought aboard. It's labeled fragile, handle with care. But so is everything, of course.
Captain Laplace drummed his fingers thoughtfully on the grained plastic wood of his desk. He hated the pattern and intended to get rid of it on the next refit. Even that slight action started him rising out of his seat, and he automatically anchored himself by wrapping his foot around the pillar of the chair. Though he did not for a moment doubt Floyd's report, his new second officer was very competent, and the captain was pleased that he had never brought up the subject of his famous grandfather. There could be an innocent explanation. The sniffer might have been misled by other chemicals with nervous molecular bondings. They could go down into the hold and force open the package. No, that might be dangerous, and could cause legal problems as well. Best to go straight to the top. He'd have to do that anyway, sooner or later. Please bring Dr. Anderson here, and don't mention this to anyone else.
Very good, sir. Chris Floyd gave a respectful but quite unnecessary salute and left the room in a smooth, effortless glide. The leader of the science team was not accustomed to zero gravity, and his entrance was quite clumsy. His obvious genuine indignation did not help, and he had to grab the captain's desk several times in an undignified manner.
"Explosives? Of course not! Let me see the manifest.
2/456. Dr. Anderson pecked out the reference on his portable keyboard and slowly read off, "Mark 5 penetrometers, quantity 3. "Of course.
No problem."
"And just what," said the captain, "is a penetrometer?" Despite his concern, he had difficulty in suppressing a smile. It sounded a little obscene.
"Standard planetary sampling device. You drop it, and with any luck, it will give you a core up to 10 meters long, even in hard rock. Then it sends back a complete chemical analysis. The only safe way to study places like Dayside Mercury, or Io, where we'll drop the first one."
"Dr. Anderson," said the captain with great self-restraint,
"you may be an excellent geologist, but you don't know much about celestial mechanics. You can't just drop things from orbit."
The charge of ignorance was clearly unfounded, as the scientist's reaction proved.
"The idiots," he said. "Of course, you should have been notified."
"Exactly. Solid fuel rockets are classified as hazardous cargo. I want clearance from the underwriters and your personal assurance that the safety systems are adequate. Otherwise, they go overboard. Now, any other little surprises? Were you planning seismic surveys? I believe those usually involve explosives." A few hours later, the somewhat chastened scientist admitted that he had also found 2 bottles of elemental fluorine, used to power the lasers that could zap passing celestial bodies at 1,000-kilometer ranges for spectrographic sampling. As pure fluorine was about the most vicious substance known to man, it was high on the list of prohibited materials. But like the rockets that drove the penetrometers down to their targets, it was essential for the mission. When he was quite satisfied that all the necessary precautions had been taken, Captain Laplace accepted the scientist's apologies and his assurance that the oversight was entirely due to the haste with which the expedition had been organized. He felt sure that Dr. Anderson was telling the truth, but already he felt that there was something odd about the mission. Just how odd, he could never have imagined.
Chapter 23 Inferno. Before the detonation of Jupiter, Io had been second only to Venus as the best approximation to hell in the solar system. Now that Lucifer had raised its surface temperature another couple of 100 degrees, even Venus could no longer compete. The sulfur volcanoes and geysers had multiplied their activity, now reshaping the features of the tormented satellite in years rather than decades. The planetologists had given up any attempt at map-making and contented themselves with taking orbital photographs every few days. From these, they had constructed awe-inspiring time-lapse movies of Inferno in action. Lloyd's of London had charged a stiff premium for this leg of the mission, but Io posed no real danger to a ship doing a flyby at a minimum range of 10,000 kilometers, and over the relatively quiescent night side at that. As he watched the approaching yellow and orange globe, the most improbably garish object in the entire solar system, Second Officer Chris Floyd could not help recalling the time, now half a century ago, when his grandfather had come this way. Here Leonov had made its rendezvous with the abandoned Discovery, and here Dr. Chandra had reawakened the dormant computer Hal. Then both ships had flown on to survey the enormous black monolith hovering at L1, the inner Lagrange point between Io and Jupiter. Now the monolith was gone, and so was Jupiter. The mini-sun that had risen like a phoenix from the implosion of the giant planet had turned its satellites into what was virtually another solar system, though only on Ganymede and Europa were there regions with Earth-like temperatures. How long that would continue to be the case, no one knew.
Estimates of Lucifer's lifespan ranged from 1,000 to 1,000,000 years. Galaxy's science team looked wistfully at the L1 point, but it was now far too dangerous to approach. There had always been a river of electrical energy, the Io flux tube, flowing between Jupiter and its inner satellite, and the creation of Lucifer had increased its strength several hundredfold. Sometimes the river of power could even be seen by the naked eye, glowing yellow with the characteristic light of ionized sodium. Some engineers on Ganymede had talked about tapping the gigawatts going to waste next door, but no one could think of a plausible way of doing so. The first penetrometer was launched, with vulgar comments from the crew, and 2 hours later drove like a hypodermic needle into the festering satellite. It continued to operate for almost 5 seconds, 10 times its designed lifetime, broadcasting thousands of chemical, physical, and rheological measurements before Io demolished it. The scientists were ecstatic. Vandenberg was merely pleased. He had expected the probe to work. Io was an absurdly easy target. But if he was right about Europa, the second penetrometer would surely fail. Yet that would prove nothing. It might fail for a dozen good reasons, and when it did, there would be no alternative but a landing. Which, of course, was totally prohibited, not only by the laws of man. Chapter 24. Shaka the Great. Astropol, which despite its grandiose title had disappointingly little business off Earth, would not admit that Shaka really existed. The USSA took exactly the same position, and its diplomats became embarrassed or indignant when anyone was tactless enough to mention the name. But Newton's third law applies in politics as in everything else. The Bund had its extremists, though it tried, sometimes not very hard, to disown them, continually plotting against the USSA. Usually they confined themselves to attempts at commercial sabotage, but there were occasional explosions, disappearances, and even assassinations. Needless to say, the South Africans did not take this lightly. They reacted by establishing their own official counterintelligence services, which also had a rather freewheeling range of operations, and likewise claimed to know nothing about Shaka. Perhaps they were employing the useful CIA invention of plausible deniability. It is even possible that they were telling the truth. According to one theory, Shaka started as a code word, and then, rather like Prokofiev's Lieutenant Kije, had acquired a life of its own, because it was useful to various clandestine bureaucracies. This would certainly account for the fact that none of its members had ever defected or even been arrested. But there was another, somewhat far-fetched explanation for this, according to those who believed that Shaka really did exist. All its agents had been psychologically conditioned to self-destruct before there was any possibility of interrogation. Whatever the truth, no one could seriously imagine that more than 2 centuries after his death, the legend of the great Zulu tyrant would cast its shadow across worlds he never knew. Chapter 25. The Shrouded World. During the decade after the ignition of Jupiter and the spreading of the Great Thaw across its satellite system, Europa had been left strictly alone. Then the Chinese had made a swift flyby, probing the clouds with radar in an attempt to locate the wreck of the Xian. They had been unsuccessful, but their maps of Dayside were the first to show the new continents now emerging as the ice cover melted. They had also discovered a perfectly straight, 2-kilometer-long feature that looked so artificial that it was christened the Great Wall. Because of its shape and size, it was assumed to be the monolith, or a monolith, since millions had been replicated in the hours before the creation of Lucifer. However, there had been no reaction or any hint of an intelligent signal from below the steadily thickening clouds. So a few years later, survey satellites were placed in permanent orbit and high-altitude balloons were dropped into the atmosphere to study its wind patterns. Terrestrial meteorologists found these of absorbing interest because Europa, with a central ocean and a sun that never set, presented a beautifully simplified model for their textbooks. So had begun the game of European roulette, as the administrators were fond of calling it whenever the scientists proposed getting closer to the satellite. After 50 uneventful years, it had become somewhat boring. Captain Laplace hoped it would remain that way, and had required considerable reassurance from Dr. Anderson. "Personally," he had told the scientist, "I would regard it as a slightly unfriendly act to have a ton of armor-piercing hardware dropped on me at 1,000 kilometers an hour. I'm quite surprised the World Council gave you permission." Dr. Anderson was also a little surprised, though he might not have been had he known that the project was the last item on a long agenda of a science subcommittee late on a Friday afternoon. Of such trifles, history is made. "I agree, Captain. But we are operating under very strict limitations, and there's no possibility of interfering with the, Europans, whoever they are. We're aiming at a target 5 kilometers above sea level." "So I understand. What's so interesting about Mount Zeus?"
"It's a total mystery.
It wasn't even there only a few years ago, so you can understand why it drives the geologists crazy." "And your gadget will analyze it when it goes in."
"Exactly. And I really shouldn't be telling you this, but I've been asked to keep the results confidential and to send them back to Earth encrypted. Obviously, someone's on the track of a major discovery and wants to make quite sure they're not beaten to publication. Would you believe that scientists could be so petty?"
Captain Laplace could well believe it, but did not want to disillusion his passenger. Dr. Anderson seemed touchingly naive. Whatever was going on, and the captain was now quite certain there was much more to this mission than met the eye, Anderson knew nothing about it. "I can only hope, Doctor, that the Europans don't go in for mountain climbing. I'd hate to interrupt any attempt to put a flag on their local Everest." There was a feeling of unusual excitement aboard Galaxy when the penetrometer was launched, and even the inevitable jokes were muted. During the 2 hours of the probe's long fall toward Europa, virtually every member of the crew found some perfectly legitimate excuse to visit the bridge and watch the guidance operation. 15 minutes before impact, Captain Laplace declared it out of bounds to all visitors except the ship's new steward, Rosie. Without her endless supply of squeeze bulbs full of excellent coffee, the operation could not have continued. Everything went perfectly. Soon after atmospheric entry, the air brakes were deployed, slowing the penetrometer to an acceptable impact velocity. The radar image of the target, featureless, with no indication of scale, grew steadily on the screen. At -1 second, all the recorders switched automatically to high speed. But there was nothing to record.
"Now I know," said Dr. Anderson sadly, "just how they felt at the Jet Propulsion Lab when those first Rangers crashed into the moon. With their cameras blind."
Chapter 26. Night Watch. Only time is universal. Night and day are merely quaint local customs found on those planets that tidal forces have not yet robbed of their rotation. But however far they travel from their native world, human beings can never escape the diurnal rhythm set ages ago by its cycle of light and darkness. So at 0105 Universal Time, Second Officer Chang was alone on the bridge while the ship was sleeping round him. There was no real need for him to be awake either, since Galaxy's electronic sensors would detect any malfunction far sooner than he could possibly do. But a century of cybernetics had proved that human beings were still slightly better than machines at dealing with the unexpected, and sooner or later, the unexpected always happened. "Where's my coffee?" thought Chang grumpily. "It's not like Rosie to be late." He wondered if the steward had been affected by the same malaise that had overtaken both scientists and space crew after the disasters of the last 24 hours. Following the failure of the first penetrometer, there had been a hasty conference to decide the next step. One unit was left. It had been intended for Callisto, but it could be used just as easily here.
"And anyway," Dr. Anderson had argued, "we've landed on Callisto. There's nothing there except assorted varieties of cracked ice."
There had been no disagreement. After a 12-hour delay for modification and testing, penetrometer number 3 was launched into the Europan cloudscape, following the invisible track of its precursor. This time, the ship's recorders did get some data, for about half a millisecond. The accelerometer on the probe, which was calibrated to operate up to 20,000 G, gave one brief pulse before going off scale. Everything must have been destroyed in very much less than the twinkling of an eye. After a second and even gloomier post-mortem, it was decided to report to Earth and wait in high orbit round Europa for any further instructions before proceeding to Callisto and the outer moons.
"Sorry to be late, sir," said Rose McMahon.
One would never guess from her name that she was slightly darker than the coffee she was carrying.
"But I must have set the alarm wrong."
"Lucky for us," the officer of the watch said with a chuckle, "that you're not running the ship."
"I don't understand how anyone could run it," answered Rose. "It all looks so complicated."
"Oh, it's not as bad as it looks," said Chang. "And don't they give you basic space theory in your training course?"
Yes, but I never understood much of it. Orbits and all that nonsense."
Second Officer Chang was bored and felt it would be a kindness to enlighten his audience. And although Rose was not exactly his type, she was undoubtedly attractive. A little effort now might be a worthwhile investment. It never occurred to him that, having performed her duty, Rose might like to go back to sleep. 20 minutes later, Second Officer Chang waved at the navigation console and concluded expansively, "So you see, it's really almost automatic. You only have to punch in a few numbers and the ship takes care of the rest." Rose seemed to be getting tired. She kept looking at her watch.
"I'm sorry," said the suddenly contrite Chang. "I shouldn't have kept you up." "Oh, no. It's extremely interesting. Please go on."
"Definitely not. Maybe some other time. Good night, Rosie. And thanks for the coffee."
"Good night, sir."
Steward Third Class Rose McCullen glided, not too skillfully, toward the still open door. Chang did not bother to look back when he heard it close. It was thus a considerable shock when, a few seconds later, he was addressed by a completely unfamiliar female voice.
"Mr. Chang, don't bother to touch the alarm button. It's disconnected. Here are the landing coordinates. Take the ship down."
Slowly, wondering if he had somehow dozed off and was having a nightmare, Chang rotated his chair. The person who had been Rose McCullen was floating beside the oval hatchway, steadying herself by holding on to the locking lever of the door. Everything about her seemed to have changed. In a moment of time, their roles had been reversed. The shy steward, who had never before looked at him directly, was now regarding Chang with a cold, merciless stare that made him feel like a rabbit hypnotized by a snake. The small but deadly-looking gun nestling in her free hand seemed an unnecessary adornment. Chang had not the slightest doubt that she could very efficiently kill him without it. Nevertheless, both his self-respect and his professional honor demanded that he should not surrender without some sort of a struggle. At the very least, he might be able to gain time.
"Rose," he said,
and now his lips had difficulty in forming a name that had suddenly become inappropriate.
"This is perfectly ridiculous. What I told you just now, it's simply not true. I couldn't possibly land the ship by myself. It would take hours to compute the correct orbit, and I'd need someone to help me. A co-pilot, at least."
The gun did not waver. "I'm not a fool, Mr. Chang. This ship isn't energy limited like the old chemical rockets. The escape velocity of Europa is only 3 kilometers a second. Part of your training is an emergency landing with the main computer down. Now you can put it into practice.
The window for an optimum touchdown at the coordinates I gave you opens in 5 minutes.
That type of abort, said Chang, now beginning to sweat profusely, has an estimated 25% failure rate. The true figure was 10%, but in the circumstances he felt that a little exaggeration was justified. And it's years since I checked out on it.
In that case, answered Rose McCullen, I'll have to eliminate you and ask the captain to send me someone more qualified. Annoying, because we'll miss this window and have to wait a couple of hours for the next one.
4 minutes left. Second Officer Chang knew when he was beaten, but at least he had tried.
Let me have those coordinates, he said.
Chapter 27 Rosie. Captain Laplace woke instantly at the first gentle tapping, like a distant woodpecker, of the attitude control jets. For a moment he wondered if he was dreaming. No. The ship was definitely turning in space. Perhaps it was getting too hot on one side and the thermal control system was making some minor adjustments. That did happen occasionally, and was a black mark for the officer on duty, who should have noticed that the temperature envelope was being approached. He reached for the intercom button to call, who was it? Mr. Chang, on the bridge. His hand never completed the movement. After days of weightlessness, even a tenth of a gravity is a shock. To the captain it seemed like minutes, though it must have been only a few seconds, before he could unbuckle his restraining harness and struggle out of his bunk. This time, he found the button and jabbed it viciously. There was no reply. He tried to ignore the thuds and bumps of inadequately secured objects that had been taken unawares by the onset of gravity. Things seemed to go on falling for a long time, but presently the only abnormal sound was the muffled, far-off scream of the drive at full blast. He tore open the curtain of the cabin's little window and looked out at the stars. He knew roughly where the ship's axis should have been pointing. Even if he could only judge it to within 30 or 40 degrees, that would allow him to distinguish between the two possible alternatives. Galaxy could be vectored either to gain or to lose orbital velocity. It was losing it, and therefore preparing to fall toward Europa. There was an insistent banging on the door, and the captain realized that little more than a minute could really have passed. Second Officer Floyd and two other crew members were crowded in the narrowing passageway.
"The bridge is locked, sir," Floyd reported breathlessly. "We can't get in, and Chang doesn't answer. We don't know what's happened."
"I'm afraid I do," Captain Laplace answered, climbing into his shorts. "Some madman was bound to try it sooner or later. We've been hijacked, and I know to where, but I'm damned if I know why."
He glanced at his watch and did a quick mental calculation. At this thrust level, we'll have deorbited within 15 minutes. Make it 10 for safety. Anyway, can we cut the drive without endangering the ship?
Second Officer Yu, engineering, looked very unhappy, but volunteered a reluctant reply.
We could pull the circuit breakers and the pump motor lines and cut off the propellant supply.
Can we get at them?
Yes. They're on deck 3.
Then let's go.
Then the independent backup system would take over. For safety, that's behind a sealed bulkhead on deck 5. We'd have to get a cutter. No, it couldn't be done in time.
Captain Laplace had been afraid of that. The men of genius who had designed Galaxy had tried to protect the ship from all plausible accidents. There was no way they could have safeguarded it against human malevolence.
Any alternatives? Not in the time available, I'm afraid.
Then let's get to the bridge and see if we can talk to Chang, and whoever is with him.
And who could that be, he wondered. He refused to believe that it could be one of his regular crew.
That left?
Of course.
There was the answer.
He could see it all. Monomaniac researcher tries to prove theory. Experiments frustrated, decides that the quest for knowledge takes precedence over everything else. It was uncomfortably like one of those cheap mad scientist melodramas, but it fit the facts perfectly.
He wondered if Dr. Anderson had decided that this was the only road to a Nobel Prize. That theory was swiftly demolished when the breathless and disheveled geologist arrived, gasping.
"For God's sake, Captain, what's happening? We're under full thrust. Are we going up or down?"
"Down," answered Captain Laplace. "In about 10 minutes we'll be in an orbit that will hit Europa. I can only hope that whoever's at the control knows what he's doing." Now they were at the bridge, facing the closed door. Not a sound came from the far side. Laplace rapped as loudly as he possibly could without bruising his knuckles.
"This is the captain. Let us in."
He felt rather foolish at giving an order that would certainly be ignored, but he hoped for at least some reaction. To his surprise, he got one. The external speaker hissed into life, and a voice said, "Don't attempt anything foolish, Captain. I have a gun, and Mr. Chang is obeying my orders."
"Who was that?" whispered one of the officers. "It sounds like a woman."
"You're right," said the captain grimly. That certainly cut down the alternatives, but didn't help matters in any way.
"What do you hope to do? You know you can't possibly get away with it," he shouted, trying to sound masterful rather than plaintive.
"We're landing on Europa, and if you want to take off again, don't try to stop me." Her room's completely clean, Second Officer Chris Floyd reported 30 minutes later, when the thrust had been cut to zero and Galaxy was falling along the ellipse that would soon graze the atmosphere of Europa. They were committed. Although it would now be possible to immobilize the engines, it would be suicide to do so. They would be needed again to make a landing, although that could be merely a more protracted form of suicide.
"Rosie McMahon. Who would have believed it? Do you suppose she's on drugs?"
"No," said Floyd. "This has been very carefully planned. She must have a radio hidden somewhere in the ship. We should search for it."
"You sound like a damned cop."
"That will do, gentlemen," said the captain. Tempers were getting frayed, largely through sheer frustration and the total failure to establish any further contact with the barricaded bridge. He glanced at his watch. "Less than 2 hours before we enter atmosphere. What there is of it. I'll be in my cabin. It's just possible they may try to call me there. Mr. Yu, please stand by the bridge and report any developments at once." He had never felt so helpless in his life, but there were times when doing nothing was the only thing to do. As he left the officer's wardroom, he heard someone say wistfully, "I could do with a bulb of coffee. Rosie made the best I've ever tasted." "Yes," thought the captain grimly. "She's certainly efficient. Whatever job she tackles, she'll do it thoroughly."
Chapter 28 Dialogue. There was only one man aboard Galaxy who could regard the situation as anything but a total disaster. "I may be about to die," Rolf Vanderberg told himself, "but at least I have a chance of scientific immortality." Though that might be poor consolation, it was more than anyone else on the ship could hope for. That Galaxy was heading from Mount Zeus, he did not doubt for a moment. There was nothing else on Europa of any significance. Indeed, there was nothing remotely comparable on any planet. So his theory, and he had to admit that it was still a theory, was no longer a secret. How could it have leaked out? He trusted Uncle Paul implicitly, but he might have been indiscreet. More likely someone had monitored his computers, perhaps as a matter of routine. If so, the old scientist could well be in danger. Rolf wondered if he could, or should, get a warning to him. He knew that the communications officer was trying to contact Ganymede via one of the emergency transmitters. An automatic beacon alert had already gone out, and the news would be hitting Earth any minute now. It had been on its way now for almost an hour. "Come in," he said at the quiet knock on his cabin door.
"Oh, hello, Chris. What can I do for you?"
He was surprised to see Second Officer Chris Floyd, whom he knew no better than any of his other colleagues. If they landed safely on Europa, he thought gloomily, they might get to know each other far better than they wished.
"Hello, Doctor.
You're the only person who lives around here. I wondered if you could help me.
I'm not sure how anyone can help anyone at the moment. What's the latest from the bridge?
Nothing new. I've just left you and Gillings up there, trying to fix a mic on the door. But no one inside seems to be talking. Not surprising. Chang must have his hands full.
Can he get us down safely?
He's the best. If anyone can do it, he can. I'm more worried about getting off again.
God, I'd not been looking that far ahead. I assumed that was no problem.
It could be marginal. Remember, this ship is designed for orbital operations. We hadn't planned to put down on any major moon, though we hoped to rendezvous with Ananke and Carmi. So we could be stuck on Europa, especially if Chang has to waste propellant looking for a good landing site.
Do we know where he is trying to land? Roth asked, attempting not to sound more interested than might be reasonably expected.
He must have failed, because Chris looked at him sharply. There's no way we can tell at this stage, though we may get a better idea when he starts breaking. But you know these moons. Where do you think?
There's only one interesting place. Mount Zeus.
Why should anyone want to land there? Rolf shrugged.
That was one of the things we'd hoped to find out. Cost us two expensive penetrometers.
And it looks like costing a great deal more. Haven't you any ideas?
You sound like a cop, said Vanderberg with a grin, not intending it in the least seriously.
Funny. That's the second time I've been told that in the last hour. Instantly, there was a subtle change in the atmosphere of the cabin, almost as if the life support system had readjusted itself.
Oh, I was just joking. Are you?
If I was, I wouldn't admit it, would I? That was no answer, thought Vanderberg. But on second thought, perhaps it was. He looked intently at the young officer, noticing, not for the first time, his striking resemblance to his famous grandfather. Someone had mentioned that Chris Floyd had only joined Galaxy on this mission from another ship in the Sung fleet, adding sarcastically that it was useful to have good connections in any business. But there had been no criticism of Floyd's ability. He was an excellent space officer. Those skills might qualify him for other part-time jobs as well. Look at Rosie McMahon, who had also, now he came to think of it, joined Galaxy just before this mission. Rolf Vanderberg felt he had become enmeshed in some vast and tenuous web of interplanetary intrigue. As a scientist, accustomed to getting, usually, straightforward answers to the questions he put to nature, he did not enjoy the situation. But he could hardly claim to be an innocent victim. He had tried to conceal the truth, or at least what he believed to be the truth. And now the consequences of that deceit had multiplied like the neutrons in a chain reaction, with results that might be equally disastrous. Which side was Chris Floyd on? How many sides were there? The Bund would certainly be involved once the secret had leaked out. But there were splinter groups within the Bund itself, and groups opposing them. It was like a hall of mirrors. There was one point, however, on which he did feel reasonably certain. Chris Floyd, if only because of his connections, could be trusted. I'd put my money, thought Vanderberg, on his being assigned to Astropol for the duration of the mission, however long or short that might now be. I'd like to help you, Chris, he said slowly. As you probably suspect, I do have some theories, but they may still be utter nonsense. In less than half an hour, we may know the truth. Until then, I prefer to say nothing. And this is not, he told himself, merely ingrained Boer stubbornness. If he had been mistaken, he would prefer not to die among men who knew that he was the fool who had brought them to their doom. Chapter 29 Descent. Second Officer Chang had been wrestling with the problem ever since Galaxy had been successfully, to his surprise as much as his relief, injected into transfer orbit.
For the next couple of hours, she was in the hands of God, or at least Sir Isaac Newton. There was nothing to do but wait until the final braking and descent maneuver. He had briefly considered trying to fool Rose by giving the ship a reverse vector at closest approach, and so taking it out into space again. It would then be back in a stable orbit, and a rescue could eventually be mounted from Ganymede. But there was a fundamental objection to this scheme. He would certainly not be alive to be rescued. Though Chang was no coward, he would prefer not to become a posthumous hero of the spaceways. In any event, his chances of surviving the next hour seemed remote. He had been ordered to take down, single-handed, a 3,000-tonner on totally unknown territory. This was not a feat he would care to attempt even on the familiar moon.
"How many minutes before you start breaking?" asked Rosie.
Perhaps it was more of an order than a question. She clearly understood the fundamentals of astronautics, and Chang abandoned his last wild fantasies of outwitting her.
5, he said reluctantly. "Can I warn the rest of the ship to stand by?" "I'll do it. Give me the mic." "This is the bridge. We start breaking in 5 minutes. Repeat, 5 minutes. Out."
To the scientists and officers assembled in the wardroom, the message was fully expected. They had had one piece of luck. The external video monitors had not been switched off. Perhaps Rose had forgotten about them. It was more likely that she had not bothered. So now, as helpless spectators, quite literally a captive audience, they could watch their unfolding doom. The cloudy crescent of Europa now filled the field of the rear-view camera. There was no break anywhere in the solid overcast of water vapor recondensing on its way back to Nightside. That was not important, since the landing would be radar-controlled until the last moment. It would, however, prolong the agony of observers who had to rely on visible light. No one stared more intently at the approaching world than the man who had studied it with such frustration for almost a decade. Rolf Vandenberg, seated in one of the flimsy low-gravity chairs with the restraining belt lightly fastened, barely noticed the first onset of weight as braking commenced. In 5 seconds, they were up to full thrust. All the officers were doing rapid calculations on their comm sets. Without access to navigation, there would be a lot of guesswork, and Captain Laplace waited for a consensus to emerge. 11 minutes, he announced presently, assuming he doesn't reduce thrust level. He's at max now, and assuming he's going to hover at 10 kilometers, just above the overcast, and then go straight down. That could take another 5 minutes. It was unnecessary for him to add that the last second of those 5 minutes would be the most critical. Europa seemed determined to keep its secrets to the very end. When Galaxy was hovering motionless, just above the cloudscape, there was still no sign of the land or sea beneath. Then, for a few agonizing seconds, the screens became completely blank, except for a glimpse of the now extended and very seldom used landing gear. The noise of its emergence a few minutes earlier had caused a brief flurry of alarm among the passengers. Now they could only hope that it would perform its duty. "How thick is this damn cloud?" Vandenberg asked himself. "Does it go all the way down?" No, it was breaking, thinning out into shreds and wisps. And there was the new Europa, spread out, it seemed, only a few thousand meters below. It was indeed new. One did not have to be a geologist to see that. 4 billion years ago, perhaps, the infant Earth had looked like this, as land and sea prepared to begin their endless conflict. Here, until 50 years ago, there had been neither land nor sea, only ice. But now the ice had melted on the Lucifer-facing hemisphere, the resulting water had boiled upward and been deposited in the permanent deep freeze of Nightside. The removal of billions of tons of liquid from one hemisphere to the other had thus exposed ancient seabeds that had never before known even the pale light of the far distant sun. Someday, perhaps, these contorted landscapes would be softened and tamed by a spreading blanket of vegetation.
Now they were barren lava flows and gently steaming mud flats, interrupted occasionally by masses of upthrust rock with strangely slanting strata. This had clearly been an area of great tectonic disturbance, which was hardly surprising if it had seen the recent birth of a mountain the size of Everest. And there it was, looming up over the unnaturally close horizon. Rolf Vanderberg felt a tightness in his chest and a tingling of the flesh at the back of his neck. No longer through the remote, impersonal senses of instruments, but with his own eyes, he was seeing the mountain of his dreams. As he well knew, it was in the approximate shape of a tetrahedron, tilted so that one face was almost vertical. That would be a nice challenge to climbers, even in this gravity, especially as they couldn't drive pitons into it. The summit was hidden in the clouds, and much of the gently sloping face turned toward them was covered with snow. "Is that what all the fuss is about?" muttered someone in disgust. "Looks like a perfectly ordinary mountain to me. I guess that once you've seen one..." He was shushed angrily into silence. Galaxy was now drifting slowly toward Mount Zeus as Chang searched for a good landing place. The ship had very little lateral control, as 90% of the main thrust had to be used merely to support it. There was enough propellant to hover for perhaps 5 minutes. After that, he might still be able to land safely, but he could never take off again. Neil Armstrong had faced the same dilemma almost 100 years ago, but he had not been piloting with a gun aimed at his head. Yet, for the last few minutes, Chang had totally forgotten both gun and Rosie. Every sense was focused on the job ahead. He was virtually part of the great machine he was controlling. The only human emotion left to him was not fear, but exhilaration. This was the job he had been trained to perform. This was the highlight of his professional career, even as it might be the finale. And that was what it looked like it was becoming. The foot of the mountain was now less than a kilometer away, and he had still found no landing site. The terrain was incredibly rugged, torn with canyons, littered with gigantic boulders. He had not seen a single horizontal area larger than a tennis court, and the red line on the propellant gauge was only 30 seconds away. But there, at last, was a smooth surface, much the flattest he'd seen. It was his only chance within the time frame. Delicately, he juggled the giant, unstable cylinder toward the patch of horizontal ground. It seemed to be snow-covered. Yes, it was. The blast was blowing the snow away. But what's underneath? Looks like ice. Must be a frozen lake. How thick? How thick? The 500-ton hammer blow of Galaxy's main jets hit the treacherously inviting surface. A pattern of radiating lines spread swiftly across it. The ice cracked and great sheets started to overturn. Concentric waves of boiling water hurtled outward as the fury of the drive blasted into the suddenly uncovered lake. Like the well-trained officer he was, Chang reacted automatically, without the fatal hesitations of thought. His left hand ripped open the safety lock bar. His right grabbed the red lever it protected and pulled it to the open position. The abort program, peacefully sleeping ever since Galaxy was launched, took over and hurled the ship back up into the sky.